Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. Hey guys, I'm Georgia and welcome back for another episode in my mystery series, where today we're going to be exploring what is technically a solved case, but a case that still has a lot of questions surrounding it. Jens Søring was convicted of the murder of his girlfriend's parents in Virginia in 1990 after making a full confession. However, he pled not guilty at trial, stating that he only made a false confession to protect his girlfriend, Elizabeth Haysom, who he now says is the one who committed the crime. As the son of a diplomat, he wrongly assumed he would get diplomatic immunity. Jens was given 2 consecutive life sentences for first-degree murder, whilst Elizabeth was sentenced to 90 years for 2 counts of accessory to murder before the fact. Both of them were released on parole towards the end of 2019 after serving 30 years of their sentences, but to this day, Jens protests his innocence. He even wrote multiple books whilst he was in prison, a lot of them about life as a prisoner and life as a self-professed innocent prisoner. Since his release, Jens has set off on a mission to get his name cleared once and for all. Elizabeth Haysom has always remained relatively silent about her part in the case, and her story has remained pretty much the same since her original account. This is a fascinating case with lots of politics and legal proceedings and conflicting evidence in each pro and con column, and I'm very intrigued to see what everyone's opinions are in the comments. This one has been an absolute minefield to research and write about. There are so many arguments on each side of the coin, and people feel very strongly about this case. We'll start with a bit of background on both Jens and Elizabeth. So Jens Søring was born the 1st of August 1966 in Bangkok as the son of a German diplomat, and as a result he spent his childhood travelling all over the world. But he did receive most of his education in the American South. At high school in Atlanta, Jens had been the editor of the school newspaper, he was in the school plays, he played guitar in garage bands, and he took multiple AP classes. He was, for lack of a better word, your typical high school nerd. And as a nerd myself, I don't mean that in any derogatory kind of way. He was smart, he wanted a good education, and he planned to get admitted to some of the most elite German universities. But then he got admitted to the University of Virginia as a Jefferson Scholar, a highly coveted and competitive scholarship, said to be one of the most highly selective scholarships in the USA. Only the best of the best got offered this, and Jens was one of those, so he accepted it. Elizabeth Haysom was born on the 15th of April 1964 in Rhodesia, South Africa, what is now Zimbabwe, but she was a Canadian citizen. Her parents were Derek Haysom, who worked high up in the steel industry, and Nancy Haysom, an artist who was related to the prominent high society family, the Astors. It took me ages to figure out where I knew that name from, the Astors, but eventually I figured it out. John Jacob Astor was the wealthiest passenger aboard the Titanic. That's how much money they had. Elizabeth had quite the teenage years, it seems. She was a wild child. She attended this fancy boarding school just outside of London, and she completely bombed her interview to get into Cambridge. So she blew off her A-levels and ran away to Europe with a female lover, and she travelled for many months partying and doing drugs. Eventually, she returned back to her parents in Virginia, feeling a bit lost and not really knowing what to do with her life. But she does eventually get into the University of Virginia as an Eccles Scholar, another elite scholarship they offered. She was 20 years old by this point, so was starting university later than most of her classmates. And she would first meet Jens Søring at orientation, but it wasn't love at first sight or anything like that, they just didn't pay much attention to each other at first. Elizabeth was a popular girl, she had many friends, and she was just like effortlessly cool, and she'd already lived a million lives by the age of 20. As one documentary I watched on this case said, Elizabeth Haysom was one of the hottest and most intelligent girls on campus. Jens Søring, on the other hand, was barely a man. He had the physique of a teenage boy, because that's what he was. He wore these big, thick glasses, he wasn't the most social of people, and he was incredibly socially inexperienced, and also very argumentative and hot-headed. He just wasn't the kind of person you'd ever put with Elizabeth Haysom. But eventually, the two started to be pulled towards each other like magnets. In the October, they went to see a movie together. In November, they were having date nights, and they fell hard for each other. Elizabeth liked his Europeanness, the fact he played guitar, his big ambitions. Over the coming months, they would exchange several love letters, and it was clear their feelings were really strong. They had a lot of this sexual tension built up between them. Now, these love letters were pretty intense. Some of them were pages and pages long. I'll leave a link down below where you can go and read some of them if you wish, but what was probably one of the first letters in which Elizabeth expressed her feelings for Jens reads, "I love you, and it may alter intensity and direction from time to time, and I will always love you with a part of me which no one else will be able to snatch." Their relationship happened unexpectedly and fast. Once they confessed their feelings for each other, there was no way this couple could be torn apart. Apart from the fact their parents lived nowhere near each other. Over the Christmas break that year, Jens was forced back to Detroit and Elizabeth to her parents' remote house in Virginia, a place called Loose Chippings near Lynchburg. That first Christmas break was really hard for them. They missed each other so much, prompting pages-long letters. Again, the letters will be linked down below, but they're an odd read. Jens strikes me as quite pretentious in his writing, showing off his intelligence. Or maybe he wasn't showing off, maybe that's just how he was. But there's this weird contrast between the sophisticated, pretentious way he writes and the small teenage boy he appeared to look like on the outside. Elizabeth's letters seem to be much more of a stream of conscience, but you could tell that she was also very well educated. And it wasn't only the distance from each other that made being home hard, they each had their own home life troubles. Jens didn't have the best relationship with his father, who had a bad temper, and his mother was an alcoholic, and he would write in one of his letters that he despised his parents, writing, "I let them know in subtle ways so they can't confront me with it too. My mother is in deep mental anguish, and do I help her? No. My last ties with my father are broken. He is worse than he used to be and he's losing his last redeeming quality. He knows nothing about me, we have nothing to talk about. He trusts no one, is loved by no one, yet he thinks he is loved." Which is this very like introspective look at a relationship with your parents. Elizabeth's relationship with her parents was definitely no better. Her father was this authoritarian figure, he was older, said to be a man of a previous generation, he just didn't understand Elizabeth. She would write in a letter on the 21st of December 1984 describing her day. "My parents began to drink. My father says that the juniper extract used to flavour gin is a potent poison or drug. It causes similar aggression as speed. My mother begins her sixth gin. I pray she will use the poker, my cold guiding father." She's wishing that her mother harms her father. But chillingly, Jens' response came. "Were I to meet your parents, I have the ultimate weapon. Strange things are happening within me. I'm turning more and more into a Christ figure, a small limitation anyway, I think. I believe I could either make them completely lose their wits, get heart attacks, or they would become lovers in an agape kind of way of the rest of the world." This particular letter wouldn't serve to be too helpful for Jens in the coming months. Elizabeth just didn't have a bond with her parents. They didn't understand her, she didn't understand them. She thought they were controlling and nagging, she just wanted to be left alone. And in coming letters over the months, she would spend a lot of time pondering on their deaths, counting down the days until she could leave for good. And Jens would have done anything for the woman he loved. The question is, did he? Elizabeth first introduced Jens to her parents in early 1985 when they came to the university in Charlottesville to take the couple for lunch. According to reports, Derek and Nancy Haysom were not impressed. They grilled Jens about his family and his past, trying to ensure that he was good enough for their daughter. They came from a family of very good standing and they expected Elizabeth to choose a partner in the same vein. And apparently they just found Jens to be all-round odd, this weird boy. They would talk to extended family members over the coming weeks about the strange lunch and the strange boy. They pressured Elizabeth to end her relationship with Jens, but of course she refused. But her entire lifestyle was funded by her parents, and if she didn't do as they wished, there was a chance they could remove this financial help and Elizabeth be left at a loose end. But this is all just teenagers being melodramatic, right? All teenagers are frustrated by their parents. Perhaps Jen and Elizabeth were just more dramatic than most. It doesn't mean they did anything, does it? But then Nancy and Derek Haysom were found dead in their Loose Chippings home. They were found by a close family friend, Annie Massey, on the 3rd of April, but it was clear they'd been dead already for a number of days. It's speculated that they died at some point between the 29th and the 31st of March. Derek was 72 years old and Nancy was just 53, and it was very clear to investigators from the get-go that this was a personal attack. It was savage. Derek's body was found lying by the front door of the home, having been stabbed 36 times. It was overkill. The perpetrator would have continued the attack long after it was clear that Derek was gone. Nancy was found in the kitchen, having been stabbed 6 times. Most of the anger had clearly been reserved for Derek, but both of them had been stabbed directly in the heart, and they had both been nearly decapitated, their necks cut ear to ear. The blood around Nancy was in faded swirls, as if somebody had tried half-heartedly to clean it up. Chuck Reed was an investigator working on this case in the early days, and he told ABC News' 2020, "It was up close and personal. To me, it was like a slaughterhouse." Investigators were able to determine early on that this definitely wasn't a burglary gone wrong. Nothing was missing from the house, including Nancy's purse that was full of cash. There was no sign of forced entry, and whoever had done this had done it because they were mad at either Nancy or Derek or both. In the early days, rumours flew around of this being the work of a gang or a cult. That's how unhinged these murders seemed to be. There were even rumours of voodoo and witchcraft. The dining room table was set for dinner and there were remnants of Nancy and Derek's last meal. There were no weapons found at the property, but there were footprints in blood. Whoever had done this hadn't been particularly careful. One of the footprints looked to be made by a tennis shoe and two more by a foot in just a sock. Testing showed that both Derek and Nancy had incredibly high blood alcohol levels at the time of their deaths, 0.22%. Bear in mind that the legal driving limit in Virginia is 0.08%, so they were nearly 3 times over the limit. It seems Elizabeth's tales of her parents drinking very much had basis in reality. They found fingerprints in a vodka bottle, but those would later prove to be Elizabeth's own, which wasn't strange seeing as it was her parents' home and she spent a lot of time there. They also found quite a lot of blood, the Haysoms' own as indicated by their type A and type AB blood, but also blood from other sources. They found a bit of type B blood on a damp rag in the washing machine, and several droplets of type O blood were found on the screen door and a few droplets in the main bedroom as well. This was 1985, before the DNA testing of today, so all they had to go on was the type of blood. They couldn't delve into it any deeper than that. When investigators sprayed Luminol in the driveway, they found more footprints that abruptly stopped, as if somebody had stepped into a car and driven away, making their swift exit from the crime scene. Footprints also showed that somebody had left the house at one point before walking back inside. Elizabeth found out about her parents' death on the Wednesday, a few days after they had taken place and the same day the bodies had been found by Annie Massey. Nothing about her response to finding out both of her parents had been murdered rang any alarm bells for investigators immediately, but it wouldn't take long for some questions to be raised. The whole crime scene at the Haysoms' home was baffling. There was no known motive for anyone who would want to hurt the Haysoms, and as there was no sign of forced entry, it was clear that their killer had been let into the house voluntarily. The Haysoms had just eaten dinner, and it seemed like their killer had joined them. It had to be someone they knew. Desperate for any leads, the sheriff's office called the FBI headquarters in nearby Quantico and asked for a profiler to be sent out to give them further clues as to the mindset of the killer. Ed Sulzbach was the profiler they sent to take a quick, cursory look at the scene, and he did make some interesting observations, saying he thought it was likely the attacker was female and had known the victims personally. But other than that, he didn't say much more. The investigators didn't have time to wait for a full, complex FBI profile because there's a whole lot of paperwork and bureaucracy that goes into that, and the sheriff's office just didn't have time. All members of the Haysom family were investigated and questioned, which did lead to investigators briefly suspecting an ex-fiancé of Julian Haysom, who was Elizabeth's older half-brother. According to the article Blood Ties in The New Yorker by Nathan Heller, that engagement had ended because Derek and Nancy didn't really approve. But Julian denied this and said that his parents were disappointed by the end of that engagement. It was his choice. Rumour had it that just a few weeks before the murder, this woman, the ex-fiancé, had bought knives to a friend and asked him to take them from her because evil spirits were pursuing her. Interesting, but this lead didn't really pan out. The woman was found to have nothing to do with the murders. But the interviews with family members did lead investigators to find out about the tension between Elizabeth and her parents. How she simply didn't like them, how she was a bit of a wild child and her parents disapproved of her lifestyle. And then when they interviewed Elizabeth, they got the impression that she was holding things back. A local man who attended Derek and Nancy's funeral got in contact with investigators to say that he'd noticed that Jens had a bruise on his face and bandages on his fingers, which piqued their interest even more. Jens and Elizabeth were looking more suspect by the day. And it didn't help that Elizabeth's other half-brother, Howard, also said that he suspected the couple and just didn't get good vibes from Jens in general. But what could the motive be? It didn't help that Jens and Elizabeth also had a pretty much airtight alibi for the weekend the murders had happened. It couldn't have been them. It turns out the couple had decided to take a trip to Washington DC for the weekend to spend some quality time together and see the sights. They'd rented a car from Charlottesville, where the university was, and had driven up to DC where they stayed in the Marriott Hotel. This stay was confirmed by their receipt. They checked in on the 29th, got room service twice, and one of those orders was made around the same time the detectives were thinking the Haysoms had been murdered, and they even had tickets to two movies they went to see that night. There was no way it could have been them. The Marriott Hotel manager would later confirm that whilst they did have a surveillance camera to see people going in and out of the hotel, the footage was just monitored in real time by security and wasn't recorded, so there was no way of knowing who left the hotel and when. Nothing investigators found was able to break their alibi. It was airtight, there was nothing they could do. Except there was one thing that didn't quite make sense. Investigators had looked at the rental car the couple had used that weekend, and the log stated they had driven 669 miles. The Charlottesville campus to Washington DC and back was only a 240 mile round trip, so how had they racked up the extra 400 plus miles? When questioned, Elizabeth and Jens just said that they had got repeatedly lost on the journey, and there's not really any way to disprove this or not. They might have been lying, they might not. But you know what kind of journey would equal approximately 669 miles? The trip from Charlottesville to Washington DC, and then to the Haysom's house in Lynchburg, and then back to DC, and then back to the university in Charlottesville. Again, very interesting to investigators, but it could have just been a coincidence. As I said, their alibi couldn't be broken. Also, not even the tiniest trace of blood was found in the rental car. This was the point when they really started to question if Jens and Elizabeth could have been involved, but Elizabeth was being completely open with them, happily providing her blood and fingerprints and answering any questions they had. That summer, the couple flew to Europe for a holiday before returning back to university for summer school. They remained inseparable, and when proper university started back up again, they basically moved in together into Elizabeth's house. Not long after this, Jens was called back to be interviewed by detectives once again. This time they asked him for his fingerprints, footprints and blood so they could eliminate him as a suspect. And he refused. He said that this would reflect badly on his father if it came out that a German diplomat's son was being asked to provide blood and fingerprints in a murder investigation. It would look bad if he was deemed to be a person of interest, saying it could lead to his entire family being deported. So he had to check with the German embassy before consenting to anything. So Jens leaves, and then a little over a week later calls the detective to say that he could meet in a week's time to give his prints and blood. But before he could do this, he disappeared. He left the country, leaving a note for the detectives explaining his innocence. He wrote, "I suggest that you continue your investigation as before. Undoubtedly you'll find whom you are looking for. As for me, I'm afraid you must remain, as Officer Reed put it, only 99% sure of my innocence. From what Liz has told me of what you discovered at Loose Chippings, I can only say that I am incapable of such a thing. As you can imagine, him escaping the country catapulted Jens to the top of the suspect list. And Elizabeth, of course, soon joined him, and they would spend many months travelling around Asia and Europe together. The aforementioned New Yorker article describes how they allegedly intended to go to Thailand first to find Jens' birth certificate, because that's where he'd been born, get married and apply for Thai passports, but that didn't quite work out as they planned. They did manage to get hold of false IDs, Canadian driver's licenses, citizenship certificates and certified passport copies though, so that was going to have to be enough. At the end of the year, they headed to Canterbury, here in the UK, where they opened special bank accounts at Lloyds Bank to get cheque guarantee cards, special bank IDs that would let Lloyds honour bounce cheques up to £50. When these cards arrived several weeks later, they went to London, where they came up with a pretty ingenious and illegal plan to make money. They went round to all of the Marks and Spencer stores they could find, and one of them would buy a leather jacket for £49.50 using this cheque guarantee card. The other would then later go back to the store to return the leather jacket that they paid for by cheque in exchange for cash. They made £6,000 by doing this, and they used that money to open up another cheque guarantee account with another bank, and then they rented a flat on Baker Street. They continued with this fraud in different M&S stores across London, but on the 30th of April 1986, an employee got suspicious of their behaviour and flagged down the police. They were arrested for several offences of obtaining a pecuniary advantage by deception, fraud, and as they weren't UK residents, it was thought they would probably abscond if released on bail, so the court refused to grant it and they were kept in police custody. As part of their police investigation into the crimes, they came across some documents that raised suspicions that they'd been involved in another serious offence in the USA. The documents in question were handwritten diary entries that referenced wiping fingerprints from an apartment and from a car, and another entry that suggested that Jens was worried about having left his fingerprints on a coffee mug. When asked about these entries, Jens said that the couple were writing a crime novel and the diary entries were ideas for a book. Not quite buying it, on the 29th of May, the London detectives in charge of this case called Ricky Gardner in Bedford, who is now the lone investigator on the Haysom case. Ricky promptly flies over to London with the Bedford County prosecutor to question the pair. They didn't have a warrant to do so, but a London magistrate ruled that they could question them over the weekend, and if they didn't find anything, they had to return home and let London get on with its fraud prosecution. Of course, by this point, police had found their real passports with their real identities, so everyone knew who everyone was. During his questioning with the US investigators, Jens did not have a lawyer present after signing lawyer waiver forms. He would later say that he only did so because one of the Metropolitan Police had threatened to harm him if he didn't talk, something the officer would later be forced to deny. Jens says that he did repeatedly ask for a lawyer. This is kind of the situation where you have no idea who to believe. We all know it's not above the Metropolitan Police to be dodgy with very questionable practices, but you also have somebody here who's a potential double murderer and a liar. So, who do you believe? You don't know. That weekend, on the 5th of June 1986, Jens would finally open up about what had happened that weekend, the Haysom's murder, over a year after it happened. He confesses. His version of the story at this point went as following. He says that whilst him and Elizabeth were driving to Washington DC that weekend, they discussed the idea of killing her parents. Knowing that this trip away was a great alibi, he left Elizabeth at the hotel to order room service and he drove alone to the Haysom's house on the 31st of March 1985. He says that he intended just to talk things through with them, and when he arrived in Loose Chippings, Derek answered the door and they all had drinks together around the dining table. Jens sat with his back to the window with Derek to his left. As the alcohol flowed further, they started arguing when the Haysoms threatened to have Jens expelled from university if he kept seeing Elizabeth. Apparently, as Jens got up to leave, Derek slammed his head against the wall, at which point Jens took out his knife and slashed Derek's neck. A fight ensued when Nancy came at him with a knife of her own, so he slashed at her neck as well. The Haysoms both ended up dead, as we know. Jens would say that he disposed of the weapons, his clothes and the tableware in a dumpster at the end of the road before returning to the house in just his socks to wipe away his fingerprints and blood, swirling the blood around Nancy to hide footprints. He then gets back in his car and drives back to Washington DC just in time to meet Elizabeth after the Rocky Horror Picture Show. It was the perfect crime and he even showed detectives the scars on his fingers from that night. But why did he confess now? Well, he thought he'd already been caught out, assuming they were there because Elizabeth had confessed or that his fingerprints were matched to the scene of the crime, or there was maybe surveillance footage of him leaving the hotel that night. None of these things had happened, but of course investigators didn't share that with him. He just thought he was backed into a corner. Jens also explained how at one point he was outside the house trying to search for the porch light, explaining why Luminol showed bloody footprints leaving the house and then returning. He does try to minimise blame where possible, saying that there wasn't a solid plan to kill the Haythams that night, that they attacked him, he said he was drunk and emotional, and that fuelled the violence. He would later say that he was under severe emotional stress from his relationship with Elizabeth. But as we know from the outset of this video, Jens now proclaims his innocence and says the only reason he made this confession was to protect Elizabeth, who he now says is the one who committed the crime. He mistakenly thought that as the son of a diplomat and making the confession in England, he would have diplomatic immunity. He didn't. He was arrested on 2 counts of first-degree murder, and whilst at first Elizabeth originally faced the same indictment, 2 counts of first-degree murder, this was later changed to an indictment as an accessory before the fact, the thinking that she was involved in the planning and execution of the murders by providing an alibi, regardless of whether or not she was actually at the crime scene. Jens's legal team desperately tried to have him tried in England or in his native Germany for these crimes, but their attempts failed. However, they did manage to get the death penalty taken off the table. The whole situation around that is super interesting in itself. Jens' legal team argue that extradition, when you know that the death penalty is possible, causes something called death row phenomenon. Essentially, it causes huge emotional distress. This could be considered inhumane or degrading treatment, which is forbidden by Article 3 of the European Convention on Human Rights. In July 1989, so jumping forward quite a few years here, the European Court of Human Rights agreed with this, saying that extradition to countries where the accused faced the death row phenomenon was unlawful. Not facing the death penalty itself, but just the wait for it was emotional distress, and that was unlawful. This, Suring versus the United Kingdom, actually became one of the most famous cases in international human rights law and has been cited in other countries abolishing capital punishment. So after this, Bedford County authorities agreed not to pursue the death penalty if Jens was extradited back to the USA. After that, Jens was soon extradited back to Virginia to stand trial. If he had been arrested in the USA for these crimes, chances are he would have found himself on death row and would probably be dead by now. Although you would think a confession of murder would be pretty cut and dry, it was noted at the time that there were some pretty big irregularities in his account of that night. Some put it down to the fact that his confession came over a year after the murders, of course he was going to get some things mixed up, but I don't know, they're pretty big points. Jens said that Nancy was wearing jeans at the time of the murders, but she was actually wearing a flowery housecoat when she was found. He said that he sat to Derek's right at the dining room table when the altercation began, but crime scene photos show that the second place was to Derek's left. This makes Jens's description of the fight that ensued pretty impossible. There's some big details to get wrong. He said that the murder weapon was a double-edged butterfly knife, a type of folding pocket knife, but the medical examiner established that a single-edged buck-type knife was used, a folding hunting knife. The weapon was completely wrong. He claimed that he threw the knife into a dumpster down the end of the Haythams Road. However, at the later trial, Elizabeth would testify that the actual murder weapon was a steak knife that had been found in the dining room table's drawer. There was also question as to how Derek's body was found in the living room by the front door and Nancy was found in the kitchen, despite the altercation starting in the dining room. How did one small teenager manage to take down both of them in different rooms with only a small knife? It's not impossible, of course, crazier things have been done, but it is an irregularity that has never really been explained. Jens' story didn't match with Elizabeth's either, who confessed to her version after Jens did. She said that Jens drove away from the murders wearing a blood-soaked sheet, having disposed of all his clothes, and then she cleaned the car with Coca-Cola. However, the rental car, as I said, was returned in immaculate condition. Forensic investigators couldn't find even a single droplet of blood. Just cleaning a car with Coca-Cola wouldn't clean it to that level. Plus, this is my own speculation, but I can imagine it would be sticky as hell. There would be some sign that had been cleaned, and there just wasn't. We're going to delve more into evidence for and against Jens' guilt in this case a little bit later in the video, but let's talk about their trials first. So both Jens and Elizabeth underwent psychological evaluations after their arrests, and Elizabeth was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, whilst Jens was diagnosed with shared delusional disorder, or Folie à deux. Folie à deux is a fascinating phenomenon in which two people share a delusional belief, the belief transmitted from one person to another. It's commonly found when two or more individuals live in close proximity, are socially or physically isolated, and have little interaction with other people. We know that for months, Jens and Elizabeth were wrapped up in their own world, in their relationship. They fed off each other, they communicated constantly, they were enamoured with each other. No one else mattered in their world, and their thoughts and delusions became each other's. That's what Jens' diagnosis said anyway. It seems that his team definitely wanted to go for some form of diminished responsibility defence, with the psychiatrist later saying that Jens was immature and inexperienced and had lost his personal identity in a symbiotic relationship with his girlfriend, a powerful, persuasive and disturbed young woman. Ultimately, this plan wouldn't work though, with people saying that his mental state at the time of the offence, in the absence of an insanity defence, was irrelevant. He still killed them. But whilst Jens was essentially battling for his life, Elizabeth agreed to extradition early on and she pleaded guilty to her charge of accessory before the fact. With a guilty plea, there was no need for a jury trial, so she simply had a 3-day hearing and a sentencing with a judge. She expressed remorse and was given 2 45-year prison sentences in 1987 and would later agree to testify at Jens's trial. At one point in questioning, she did tell the Metropolitan Police that she'd committed the murders of her parents herself, that she got off on it, but she would later deny saying that at her hearing. By this point, realising that Elizabeth had thrown him under the bus, Jens retracted his confession in its entirety, but of course, it made no difference to the proceedings, it was too late. At a pre-trial hearing, Jens claimed for the first time that he only confessed because the Metropolitan Police had threatened him if he didn't. He claims he confessed under pressure and police kept ignoring his request for a lawyer. Him and his legal team were trying to get the confession scrapped from the record to stop them from being used as part of this upcoming murder trial, but the judge ruled that Jens was lying about the threats and said the confessions could be used in their entirety. He's now claiming that Elizabeth was the one who killed her own parents, driving to Lynchburg without warning to do so in a drug-fueled rage. Regardless, he stood trial for murder, pleading not guilty from the 1st of June 1990, a trial that lasted for 3 weeks and was actually the first major trial in Virginia's history to be broadcast on TV. This was huge when it was all happening, so much so they actually had trouble finding a jury that wasn't entirely aware of the news coverage. There was also drama with the judge, Judge William W. Sweeney, who Jens' team tried to get recused. It turns out that Sweeney knew Nancy Haysom's brother pretty well and had attended a party in honour of Nancy just a few years before her death. He denied that there was any conflict of interest and he was allowed to preside over the trial, but some people today still think that he shouldn't have been the judge on it in case he was biased. So, what evidence did the prosecution present at this trial? Well, the confession was obviously a huge part of it, but also the fact that Jens' blood type is O, the same type of blood found at the Haysom's house that did not belong to either of the victims. We know that forensic DNA testing just didn't really exist back in 1985, but you could test for blood type. Jens' blood type was O, and they found type O blood at the scene, but 40 to 45% of the US population had type O blood at this time. In the original confession, Yen said that his fingers got cut during the struggle, leaving him bleeding. He said he washed himself in the kitchen and the bathroom and left the house through the front entrance. These are the locations where the typo blood was found. Jens wouldn't have known specific details about the police investigation like this before his confession. It just so happened that it matched. A huge strike against his case. Another huge part of this trial was a sock print found in the blood, which the prosecution showed overlaid with a photo of Jens's footprint, and it seemed to match perfectly. It was kind of like an OJ glove moment. Notably though, this was done by the prosecution witness himself, who some say was not qualified as an expert in this field, with many referring to it as junk science. Jurors would later say that this convinced them of Jens's guilt whilst in the courtroom, but later when taking a closer look in the jury room, it split opinion. But by Jens's own confession, he had taken his shoes off and was walking around the crime scene in only his socks, and there were sock prints found. Then on top of that, you had the mileage on the car and the fact that he did have a motive. The Hatems did not want him and Elizabeth together. And it was in writing in multiple letters that the two had fantasized about Derek and Nancy's deaths before. In fact, the only two people investigators ever found who had a legitimate motive were Jens and Elizabeth. And then Elizabeth testified herself. She'd already been convicted at this point. She had nothing to lose. Beforehand, at her own hearing, she had said, "I wasn't thinking murder, and it seems that he was." Now she said, "I was much more concerned that he would not kill them." The two had planned this together, according to her, and Jens had seen through on their plan all the way to the end. When Jens was cross-examined, it became clear to the jury that his story was full of contradictions. On the 21st of June 1990, he was found guilty of the murders of Derek and Nancy Hatem and was given the maximum punishment, bar the death penalty, life in prison for each death. That was it, case closed. But many people were still left with doubts, with questions. If you looked at all the evidence the prosecution had presented at trial, then yes, it very much looked like Jens was guilty. It didn't help that he was just a bit arrogant, overly intelligent, and not too charismatic. He didn't make the best impression on people. But if you looked at the evidence that was left out of the courtroom, then more questions were raised. And that's what we're going to look at now. We'll start with a mysterious sneaker, or as we would say here, trainer print, found at the scene of the crime. A bloody shoe print that was way too small in size to have belonged to Jens Suhring. In fact, at the time of the original crime scene investigation, the Sheriff's Department report stated that this print belonged to a woman or a small man or boy, a size 6.5 or 7.5. More definitive studies would prove that this print was too small to have been left by Jens, who wore a size 8.5 shoe. But interestingly, it was the correct size to have been worn by Elizabeth. This evidence, though, was never entered into trial. On top of this, there was also the potential judicial bias that I mentioned before, the fact that Judge Sweeney knew Nancy and had definitely run in the same circles as her. How much bias did that give him? Did he just want to see somebody punished for her death? And then a few years after this case, Jens's defence lawyer, Rick Neaton, had his licence to practice law revoked for infractions from fraud to incompetence, leading to questions as to whether Jens was properly represented at his trial. It came out that Neaton had suffered from a mental or emotional disability that impaired his ability to practice law since January 1989, 18 months before Jens's trial. How much effect had this had on the case? In 1995, Jens self-published a book called Mortal Thoughts, in which he talks about the case from his point of view in detail, and he describes how Elizabeth had been the one to kill her parents, putting the blame entirely on her. He says the trip to Washington DC was intended to be an innocent trip away, but during the trip, Elizabeth confessed that she had started using heroin and owed money to her drug dealer. According to Yen, she said that she had to go meet him, but she had to go alone, so she leaves in the rental car to go meet her drug dealer and pick up more drugs. Yen said that he waited for hours for Elizabeth to return, but she never came, so he ordered some movie tickets, ordered room service as an alibi for her in case she needed to prove to her parents that she wasn't using drugs. Yeah, I don't know either. He said that Elizabeth returned back to the hotel at 2 a.m. wearing different clothes than when she'd left and told him that she'd killed her parents in a drug-fueled rage. He said he only went on to confess to protect her, believing that he had diplomatic immunity. This all sounds a bit far-fetched, but we can't pretend that Elizabeth didn't have motive to want to kill her parents. From the letters, we can clearly see that she doesn't like them, probably even hated them. They disapproved of her relationship with Jens, who she was obsessed with. They disapproved of the way she lived her life, although considering how wild Elizabeth was, that could just be put down to standard parents being worried about their wild child. You also have the FBI profiler who came to the scene and said that he thought that the perpetrator was a woman who knew the family personally. Who knows the family more personally than their daughter? We also have the fact that type O blood reportedly wasn't the only type of blood found at the scene of the crime. If your memory is particularly good, you may recall me saying that type B blood was found on a damp rag, potentially suggesting that two people were present at the crime scene. Elizabeth's blood type? Type B. I couldn't find too much reference to this in any of my sources, bar the fact that it was there, so I don't know how the authorities explain this away. Perhaps similar to the fact that Elizabeth's fingerprints had been found in the house, they just expected that because it was her parents' home and she was there often, then maybe her blood was there too. But the rag was damp, suggesting that if this was Elizabeth's blood, then she must have been there recently. Unless the blood was on there previously and was just old, I don't know. But there was type B blood found at the scene. And then we have something huge, which has the potential to throw this entire case on its head, a potential motive for Elizabeth to be so angry at her parents. At her 1987 sentencing trial, a court-appointed psychiatrist testified that Elizabeth had been sexually abused by her mother, Nancy Haysom. This matched up with the diagnosis she had been given of borderline personality disorder, which has been known to be closely linked to childhood trauma and sexual abuse, although not always, of course. Annie Massey, the Haysom's family friend and the one who discovered them, testified that Nancy had taken nude photographs of Elizabeth and had shown them to her friends as art. On the stand, Elizabeth originally testified that she had indeed been sexually abused by her mother with her father's knowledge, but under cross-examination she retracted her testimony relating to this, so we don't have an answer either way. At this time in the 80s, sexual abuse was still a very taboo subject and something that was often tiptoed around. This would have been a huge potential motive. It would explain a lot of Elizabeth and potentially Jens' anger towards the Haysoms, but it was just kind of brushed past. Jens' trial, his attorney deliberately avoided all mention of sexual abuse to apparently avoid inflaming the jury. As I said just a moment ago, this was a huge taboo and something that wasn't really understood by the standard person. Even if it was mentioned at trial, you have no way of knowing how the jury would have responded. If this case were to be presented to a jury today with the sexual abuse evidence included, there is a chance that the crime could be explained away by this very emotional motive, a motive for Elizabeth to have been the one responsible. A big part of Jens' attorney's job at trial was to try and persuade the jury that Elizabeth had been the one responsible for the murders, but they were never given a persuasive reason as to why she would have done this. But that sexual abuse could have been it. The final massive question mark in this case is the DNA evidence. As we know, technology didn't support DNA testing back in the 80s, but lots of cases are being re-evaluated and looked at again with DNA testing available, including this case. Now bear with me because all of the new DNA evidence in this case is very complicated and it took me a while to get my head around it. I've simplified it all for your guys' sake because I read one 100 page report on it all and it just made me more confused, so this is a dummies version. In 2005, Virginia launched a new program to test DNA in old cases and they got round to Jens' case in 2009. At first, the results were all a bit underwhelming. Only 15% of the badly degraded samples from the crime scene yielded any testable DNA, and none of the DNA profiles were complete. But the partial profiles they did find did not match Jens Suhring. Yep, you heard that right. All of the partial profiles they did find, though, did match each other, so the lab worker basically ended up saying that it was probably the DNA of Derek Haysom, who had bled all over the place. But Jens' team later noticed an anomaly. Some of the DNA samples with male DNA had come from crime scene samples which had been identified as containing type AB or type O blood, meaning there had been two unidentified men at the scene, one of whom had Jens' blood type, type O, but not his DNA, whilst the other had Nancy's blood type but was male, and again, did not have Jens' DNA. Now, it's important to note they didn't come to this conclusion via extra testing, but instead just through comparing all of the different reports they had. But this was huge for Jens' case. Ultimately, whether or not he was there, Jens' DNA cannot be found in any of the remaining samples from the crime scene that day. Really, apart from it being type O blood, which as I've already said, almost half of the US population has, there's no indication that anyone other than Derek and Nancy were present at the scene. At least, this is what Jens and his defence team have claimed. Some experts fight against the so-called DNA evidence though, saying that DNA test results cannot be conflated with blood typing test results. It was found that 9 samples had too little blood on them to be tested back in 1985 for blood type, yet these same samples yielded DNA results in 2009, whilst there were 8 samples that had visible blood on them sufficient for blood typing, but yielded no testable DNA, and all of this raises questions of cross-contamination. The bottom line is though, the DNA testing neither proved nor disproved that Jens was at the Haysom's house that night, and in a world where forensic and DNA testing is everything right now, that's enough to raise questions. This was all enough to attract the attention of the authorities. The main thing for me is that Jens fought for this DNA testing to be done. If he was guilty, why would he fight for something that more than likely would have proved his guilt? There was no way for him to know that the DNA would be too degraded to show full profiles. Maybe he just got super lucky. But it seems the authorities were thinking along the same lines. Jens' lawyer filed a petition for an absolute pardon, with the governor of Virginia citing new evidence of actual innocence. By this point, Jens had gathered a huge following of people on the outside fighting for his innocence and his release, reaching them through his books and through a 2018 documentary about the case titled Killing for Love. Interestingly, even a number of investigators who worked on the case originally say they now have doubts about his involvement, although the lead investigator still believes his guilt. Jens became eligible for parole in the early 2000s, but 14 requests were denied over the years. In 2019 though, the Virginia governor accepted the Virginia Parole Board's recommendation to release both Jens and Elizabeth, with the parole board stating, "The parole board has determined that releasing Jens Suhring and Elizabeth Haysom is appropriate because of their youth at the time of the offences, their institutional adjustment, and the length of their incarceration. The release and permanent expulsion from the United States is an enormous cost benefit to the taxpayers of the Commonwealth of Virginia, and we have determined that their release does not pose a public safety risk to the community." As you can hear, both Jens and Elizabeth were to be released into the custody of ICE and were to be immediately deported back to their home countries, Germany for Jens and Canada for Elizabeth. Neither of them are ever allowed to re-enter the United States. At the time of his release in December 2019, Jens was 53 years old and had spent 33 years in prison for a murder that he claims he was innocent of. Whether or not you believe that is up to you. You might find yourself questioning why Jens would confess to a crime he allegedly didn't commit all those years ago, but false confessions do happen a lot more than you would think. It's a psychological thing, and everyone who does so has a different reason. Some people say they're threatened, others are protecting people, some just want the notoriety or they're mentally ill. Jens says he was threatened by the Metropolitan Police, but also that he thought he was protecting Elizabeth, the woman he loved. He thought he would get diplomatic immunity and wouldn't have to face trial in the USA. In statistics from the Innocence Project, who work on getting innocent people out of prison, they say of more than the 250 prisoners they've exonerated, 25% of them have confessed to crimes they definitely did not commit, the truth only being discovered through new DNA technology that proves their innocence. Jens has said that he wants a full pardon from the governor of Virginia, and he's hoping that he will reconsider his decision and grant him this pardon. But at the end of the day, the DNA test results are inconclusive. Even without the test results and all of the questioning around this case, chances are both him and Elizabeth would have been released on parole eventually anyway. Being model prisoners and decades after the murder, neither of them seem the type to recommit, but only time will tell on that. They're both still guilty of their crimes, they've just been paroled and sent home. Whilst Jens has been very outspoken about all of this, Elizabeth has stayed very quiet, and I actually don't know what she's up to now. She's just in Canada. Which is where I turn this over to you guys. What do you think of this case? I honestly have no idea where I personally stand, but I must say that I don't think this case would have stood up in court today based on the evidence they had. I don't think there's any way Jens would have been convicted today, whether he was innocent or not. That's not to say I'm convinced in his innocence, I just don't think the flimsy evidence they had, a blood type and a sock print, would be enough. Without the confession, I don't think they would have been able to convict him back then either. Then again, this case probably wouldn't have unfolded the way it did back then today, because the DNA evidence would have told us the answer pretty quickly. Either Jens is very lucky the DNA was too degraded to provide answers, or he really wasn't the one to commit this crime. Do I think Elizabeth was also at the crime scene that day? If Jens was there, if it was even them in the first place? I think it's a definite possibility. If the sexual abuse allegations were true, then there's no doubt she had a motive, a very emotional motive. But we don't have any answers. I don't really feel comfortable giving an opinion either way in this case. I simply don't know. All of the evidence is so contradictory. Thank you so much for tuning in this week, and I will see you in the next one. Bye guys.